Now, This American Moment. During the Democratic and Republican conventions, we spoke with a series of guests, politicians, journalists, writers, and thinkers. We asked each to take a step back to put this election and this campaign season in context. What's at stake? What does this election mean to them? We've decided to continue the series until Election Day. In just a minute, Ralph Reed, the former executive director of the Christian Coalition, now a Republican political strategist, joins us to share what This American Moment means to him. We also want to hear from you. Step back. Get away from the day-to-day politics. Tell us what you think is at stake here, what this moment means to you. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ralph Reed with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program again, Ralph.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you.
And you first became active in politics when you were in college. What do you think about the role of young people, which has been so important in this campaign season?
It's been remarkable. I think that really you have to go back to 1980 when Ronald Reagan so energized the youth vote. At that time, of course, the oldest major party nominee for president in American history, at least the oldest to ever be elected president, and won the 18 to 24-year-old vote overwhelmingly. Now we see Barack Obama not exclusively but largely capturing the enthusiasm of that vote. It's going to be a very interesting thing to watch, Neil, because you're going to have probably an 18 to 30-year-old vote that's going to go very lopsided for Obama. But then you look at the current polling, and McCain is leading among senior voters, those over the age of 55, by about 13 points, about 52 to 39. So you've got a little bit of a demographic kibitzu going on.
Yeah, generation gap for sure. It may not work out that way. Of course, we're still, 7 weeks away from the election. But I wondered if you thought back and give us your ideas about how your early involvement in politics shaped how you think about issues.
Well, I think my story is probably similar to everybody's story of political socialization. You know, the political scientists tell us, Neil, that however we vote in our very first election is probably how we're going to vote the rest of our lives.
Hmm.
Again, it's a statistical generalization. There are clearly important exceptions. But in general, that tends to be true. Whatever's going on at the time, whether it's the Great Depression for those who came up under FDR, or in the case of Reagan, it was the Cold War and stagflation, whatever the macro political environment looks like and whatever political figure inspires you at that moment of political socialization tends to be a very defining experience. And for me, it was Reagan and it was the Cold War. And I think a lot of us who were young conservatives on the college campuses I'm speaking of, who were coming of age in the late 70s and early 80s, we were talked to about malaise, and we were told that maybe the best days were behind, and détente sort of suggested that we were going to have to peacefully coexist with the Soviet Union. And along came this guy, Ronald Reagan, out of California, and he said, we're going to restore the economy by cutting taxes, and we're going to seek victory over the evil empire and the war between communism and capitalism, and we're going to restore the foundations of our culture and our values. And he inspired a lot of us and I think shaped, frankly, an entire generation of young conservatives.
Ronald Reagan, of course, famously ran against Washington. I think it was in his first inaugural. He said government isn't the solution, it's the problem.
Right.
And we have, in a way, two candidates this time running against Washington. They run against the institutions. They say we need change, that government is needs to be done in new ways, that we need a maverick on one side, we need change we can believe in on the other. They both accuse the other of being, you know, sort of Washington establishment. They point to the lobbyists on each person's staff. And do you think it's fundamentally healthy when our federal government does some really important things? We've been watching the stock markets the last few days. The Securities and Exchange Commission really obviously pretty important, and both are now calling for new kinds of regulations. But this kind of vitriol directed against the nation's government, is this healthy, do you think?
I think the answer to that is probably, you know, yes and no. I think it's healthy to have a skepticism about centralized power. I think the founders felt very strongly about that. Of course, it was particularly resonant at the beginning of the country because they had just fought a war to be independent from a central power. And so there was this real emphasis on a decentralized government, no standing army, no real power, etc. Over time, of course, that was unrealistic, particularly as we became a global power, and especially after World War II. I mean, it's really after World War II that the United States becomes the financial, military, and economic power in the world. So I think the American people have an understanding that when it comes to a regulatory regime to deal with global financial markets, there's clearly a role for government. I think what they're really reacting to, Neil, is a sense that Washington is disjointed and disconnected from Main Street and from the values of the heartland. And I think whether it's something like the feeling that maybe there should have been tighter regulation and the closeness between lobbyists and those who governed didn't allow that to take place, or whether or not it's they feel that, you know, for example, with regard to the global economy, there's economic anxiety about the future of their job security. These are all being reflected. And, of course, McCain, as a Republican, is reflecting a unique conservative or Republican brand of that. It's anti-earmarks. It's anti-spending. It's devolved power out of Washington. It is a change election, and so they both got to find ways to be agents of change.
And I want to get some listeners in on this conversation, too, but I do need to ask you, you were involved in the lobbying business some yourself and tangentially connected with Jack Abramoff,
right.
And that's going to be an issue for the next president. Do you think we need fundamental reform for the way this business works?
I think we do, and I supported the legislation that John McCain and Barack Obama, both on a bipartisan basis, passed to greater regulate and provide for greater transparency. I would just simply point out that with regard to, you know, whether it was the earmark scandals that brought down Duke Cunningham or the stuff that Jack Abramoff did that he pled guilty to, or whether or not you've seen other scandals in the other party, those activities are already against the law. So I'm not saying you don't need more transparency. What I am saying is that the law properly prosecuted against what was already being done that was wrong is sufficient.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Our guest again on This American Moment, Ralph Reed, former executive director of the Christian Coalition, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. What does This American Moment mean to you? Brian is calling. Brian with us from Elkhart, Indiana.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I just want to make the comment that I find that there's this shift going on, and I welcome it from a Christian right to a Christian left in that I've always been supportive of many of the aspects of both parties and, you know, opposed to things like abortion. But on the other hand, I've always been dismayed at this idea that business and the wealthy have always been kind of the supported aspect. Now we see the more shift of the what I guess you'd call it the Christian left coming out saying, hey, you know, the rich are too rich and the poor aren't getting anything. The middle income guys are being squeezed. And, you know, why is so much of the Christian community supporting, you know, these aspects, but they're not focusing on the things that would prevent things like abortion and all the ills that have come about. So I'll take my thing off the air.
Okay, Brian, thanks very much. And Ralph Reed, I'd like to hear your response to that, but also to the question as it's put by a lot of people in this campaign that the growing gap between the rich and the poor is something that sort of undermines fundamentally our belief in our society.
Well, I think, you know, here again, the question is, as a public policy matter, what do you do about that? I mean, if you take the people in the lower quartile socioeconomically, their incomes have risen by about 25% in real after-inflation terms since the early 80s. So clearly a rising tide has lifted all boats. But there's no question that people look at Wall Street and they look at, you know, say a hedge fund manager who makes $500 million in a single year, and there's a feeling that there's inequity.
Yeah, it seems to have lifted the yachts a lot quicker.
Right. I think the question, though, is what do you do about it? And here I think you have a divergence of visions. I think in the case of Barack Obama, I think he thinks the way to address that is primarily through the tax code by so-called, quote-unquote, taxing the rich. Here's the problem with that. If you take the IRS's own figures, 67% of all the taxes paid by those making over $250,000 a year are paid by small businesses. These are limited liability partnerships or corporations that file on people's tax returns. They create 85% of the new jobs in the country. So while trying to quote-unquote soak the rich, you don't want to punish the engine of job creation and the engine of wealth for the people who haven't yet made it. Let me also say something real quickly about the role of faith that the caller referred to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the more interesting stories that the media has been following during this campaign is whether or not the evangelical vote isn't moving from being a more solidly Republican vote to more of a jump ball. Barack Obama is arguably the most comfortable Democratic politician to win his party's nomination for president with faith and with expressing his faith since Jimmy Carter in 1976. And yet I think after the Saddleback Civil Forum, where I think everybody agrees McCain had a great night, Obama less so, and after the selection of Palin, we're really seeing in the polling kind of a return to the previous pattern. The Time magazine poll shows McCain winning about 70% of the self-identified evangelical vote, Obama winning only 19%. Obama right now is winning a smaller percentage of that vote than John Kerry was at this point 4 years ago. So again, with the caveat you already said, 7 weeks to go, 47 days is a long time, but it looks like McCain's been able to solidify that vote, which 6 months ago nobody would have thought was possible.
We're talking on This American Moment with Ralph Reed. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Barbara on the line. And Barbara's calling us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Barbara.
First of all, I'm one of the exceptions that you talked about. I was raised in a very Republican, very Christian home. And in my 20s, I rejected all of that completely. And the thing that worries me most about this election is that in the next couple of years, we're going to probably choose between one and three Supreme Court justices. And depending on who's president, Roe v. Wade, will be overturned. And that's why this election is so incredibly important to me, that we get somebody in there who will not put injustices that want to determine a woman's right to choose from thousands of miles away.
And Ralph Reed, I know you come at this from the opposite point of view, but I don't think you would disagree that the Supreme Court and what happens on Roe v. Wade is one of the big issues, one of the big things at stake in this election.
I agree, Neil. I think it's one of the sleeper issues out there. I wouldn't by any stretch say that it's one of the top five or seven issues, but I think
I guess that depends on if you're a woman or not. One of the top issues.
What I was getting ready to say was I think among very energized partisans in each candidate's camp, I think there are a lot of people who are following this, and that's why I said I think it's a sleeper issue. And by the way, you couldn't really have a starker contrast. I mean, John McCain gave a speech at the Wake Forest University School of Law, not far from where you're calling from in Chapel Hill, actually, earlier in the spring, in which he talked about why he wanted to appoint judicial conservatives, because he believed that the rule of law was undermined when judges began to act as legislators rather than interpreters of law. On the other side, you have in Obama a former associate professor of law at the University of Chicago, somebody who's a very bright guy, editor of the Law Review at Harvard Law School. He was one of only 22 members of the Senate who voted against John Roberts for the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, even Pat Leahy voted for Roberts. So you've got a pretty stark contrast, and I think it is going to be one of the sleeper issues that's going to drive turnout and energize a lot of the activists in both parties.
Barbara, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can go now to Tricia. Tricia with us from Vestal in New York.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to make a comment that I think overall in today's age, people need to focus again on accountability. Both citizens, politicians, overall, I don't think people hold themselves accountable for following through on the things that they say they will do.
And could you give us an example?
I guess probably maybe when Bush was elected, he made all these campaign promises that he would try, to make makes I'm sorry, I'm nervous.
That's
here.
Quite all right. We all get nervous on the radio. Is this a uniter, not a divider kind of a thing?
Right, yeah, to unite us, exactly. And that never happened, actually. It's much, much worse than I can ever remember it being.
It's certainly as bad as anybody can remember it being, Tricia, but of course this is a two-way street. The president doesn't get to choose this entirely on his own, but nevertheless, Ralph Reed isn't, and Tricia, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
History is really the person, the agency that defines accountability for a president of the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, and for those of us who knew and worked with President Bush when he was governor of Texas and really was seen as an extraordinarily bipartisan agent of governance, worked very closely with the late Bob Bullock, who was then the Democrat lieutenant governor of the state, a really powerful figure in state government, it's been disappointing, I think, for everybody to see that what he wanted to happen did not occur. Now, I don't want to do a long history lesson here, but just quickly, let's remember that No Child Left Behind and his tax cut in the spring of 2001 both passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. Remember, Ted Kennedy was the chief co-sponsor in the Senate, and the chief co-sponsor in the House was George Miller, a liberal Democrat from California. And even the decision to take military action in Iraq at the beginning was a bipartisan vote. It was really later, after Iraq became so difficult, that this situation became so polarized.
Ralph Reed, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Ralph Reed, former executive director of the Christian Coalition, now a Republican political strategist, with us from NPR's bureau in New York. Tomorrow, Ira Flatow's here with Science Friday. We'll see you again on Monday. Have a great weekend. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.